This is Rosemary Hall, recording on behalf of the Dialect and Heritage Project. It's Tuesday the 29th of November 2022. And could I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Yes, Rosie. My name is Bren Neal. And I did my PhD in the Institute way back in the 1970s. And also, I joined the Institute to do a postgrad diploma and then went on to do a doctorate there. And I also worked as the archivist part-time for some years. So that's my two sides to my involvement.
Okay, thank you. Can you tell me about how you first came to join the Institute?
Yeah, I had done a first degree at Manchester Polytechnic, as it then was, and it was a joint degree in information studies and sociology. And so, and in fact, by the time I finished that degree, which was in 74, I think, I was a qualified librarian. But also really quite got into the sociology. But I wouldn't really, I couldn't ever call myself a sociologist back then because I was interested in people's ordinary everyday lives. And I did a dissertation then working on an anthropologist called Lucy Mayer, who did that thing of going out and immersing herself in a local community and building up links with it over many, many years. And so I was really coming at it much more from an anthropological point of view. And the IDFLS was kind of urban anthropology. I mean, it's, you know, that's the sort of link. And my then husband, we got married in 1974, and he was a student at Leeds. So when I finished my degree, I wanted to come across to Leeds from Manchester. And I discovered that there was something called this Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies, which sounded quite fascinating, and that it was possible to do a postgrad diploma. So I signed up for that. And I'm not quite sure at what point, but at some point in my journey as a student there, I became the archivist. The archivist post must have become vacant. So I had those two roles. So I think it must have been 1974, 75, around that time, I did this postgrad diploma. And it was quite fascinating. So I mean, Stuart Sanderson was the main lecturer, but also Tony Green, who ended up supervising my doctorate. And it was the most unacademic place you could possibly imagine. Absolutely, you know, even coming from Manchester Poly, it was completely unacademic. And I remember Stuart saying to me, "Do you know what you might do for your dissertation?" And I said, "No, I haven't got a clue really." And he said, "Well, I've got this handwritten script here that's been discovered, and it's from a lady collector from the 19th century, who was living down in I don't know near Bristol somewhere, and she was a sort of one of those archetypal collectors of flotsam and jetsam and, you know, bits of stuff. And it was mostly people's sayings, like, you know, a stitch in time saves nine and so on. And he said, "Do you think you could work your way through that and annotate it?" And I had no idea what he meant. I thought, "What does he mean, annotate? I don't know what to do with this." So that was my piece of work that I did. But all the way through, I kept thinking, you know, I've come at this from a sociological background, so I need to know what people, you know, what motivates people and why people are doing the things that they're doing, and, you know, what are all the social factors that lead people down one path or another. And there's none of that in this. It's just a bit of folkloristic stuff. But, you know, that was where Stuart was coming from. Very traditional. Anyway, I did this piece of work. And somehow or other managed to get a distinction. And I was doing exactly the same course as the MA students. There wasn't a distinction. It was just that, you know, I'd come from a poly and therefore I didn't have a sort of, the kind of, you know, it was a CNAA degree, so it wasn't seen as a sort of proper university degree. So anyway, that's how I sort of came into the whole thing. And as I said, it was very unacademic. So one of the cohort that I was working with me during that year was a lovely chap called Cyril Tawney, and he was a Morris dancer. And we all had to give a seminar at one point over the year, and when Cyril did his, he came in dressed in his full regalia in his Morris dancing stuff, and we all were in the seminar, and he proceeded to do Morris dancing for us, and then we had a little chat about what it all meant, you know, and why it was fun and stuff. But you know, that's what I mean about it being unacademic. Part of me is sort of taking a step back, thinking, you know, if anybody walked in the door now, they'd think, what on earth is going on? You know, this is just, you know, it wasn't what I expected from the University of Leeds somehow, but it was fine, you know, it was fine. And I can remember another occasion where we got into a detailed discussion about various sayings, one of which is that pigs fly backwards in Barnsley. And, you know, the idea that pigs fly backwards is sort of unusual. In Barnsley, pigs fly backwards. So, you know, this is a real denigration of the people of Barnsley and everything about Barnsley. But we got into a sort of half an hour debate about what that meant. And that's the kind of thing we were doing. So you can see there was that sort of dialect link. And with this thesis that I was given to do, you know, again, it was looking at language use, linguistic, you know, so there was always that element to it. So, but I suppose out of all of that, I decided that I would apply to do a PhD. But with my sociological hat on, others in the department were doing studies on well dressing or, you know, traditional arts and crafts of one sort. Simon Leishman, who's a really good friend of mine, did a study on mama's plays, and that was Tony's area, and he'd come to join Tony and they worked on that. Another very good friend of mine, Ginny Dunn, who you might have heard of, was doing traditional singing. So, you know, there was this dry stone walling, those sorts of traditional arts, crafts and so on. And what I decided to do was a study of people getting married and what that meant to them. So you can see already I'm sort of going in a more sociological direction. Although, as I said, I could never call myself a sociologist back then, because sociologists weren't interested in this ordinary everyday lives of people. They were only really interested in, you know, large surveys and statistical analysis, and I wasn't into that at all. Largely, I think, because I'm number dyslexic, so I've never gone with the numbers, you know. I'm much more interested in the narratives than the numbers. So I decided to do this, you know, put in an application, and you know, Tony was very encouraging. But you know, this is how it was back then. When I submitted my application to do a PhD, that must have been by then about 76, I don't know, something like that. I submitted a 2-page handwritten document, and I didn't need any money because I wasn't funded anyway, because I was, you know, I was doing bits of part-time work to keep myself going. I was a qualified librarian, you know. And I got accepted onto a PhD programme with a 2-page handwritten document. You know, I think it's quite amazing when I look back. But I mean, the university was a very, very different place then. And I had a dear old friend, Douglas Jefferson. I don't know if you know Douglas. He was one of the sort of revered English professors in the place, and as he got older, he used to come around and have Sunday dinner with us. But I remember once saying to Douglas, you know, when you started at Leeds, and he must have started in the sort of 50s or something, or maybe the 60s, I said, what was your workload like? And he said, my dear, he said, it was a very heavy workload. He said, I had to deliver 2 lectures a week, he said. So you can see the difference from where we are today. So that was how I started to do the PhD, very much part-time. And as I said, somewhere in that journey, I can't quite remember when it was, I became the archivist. And what I inherited was a room, a rather nice big room, with tables and chairs, and all the students would come in and it was their quiet study space. And a complete hodgepodge of bits of data, various dissertations that had been done, memorabilia, and it was in complete chaos. And so what I set out to do was to catalogue the whole thing and organise it properly and, you know, try and find some themes in it so that you could find your way around it, you know. But that didn't take that long. It was probably, a few months of that. And thereafter, I mean, my hours of work were 9 to 12 in the morning every day, so there was always an archivist there if needed. And then I would do my research in the afternoons. So it was a very nice life. So, at that time, the School of English, of course, wasn't where it is now in the lovely buildings. It was in the what's now the physics block, or maybe attached to the physics block. But those, you know, nondescript, high-rise, plate glass sorts of buildings. So not particularly great in terms of an environment, but you know that's where we were. So what I would do, I'd just go in and be the archivist, and I was sort of, you know, I maybe have one thing to catalogue in a day or something like that. And that was my life for through to probably from about 75, 76 through to 1980. So I was doing my doctorate part time, and then at the archivist work in the morning. And one of the things that was kind of fortuitous, because I wanted to follow people through the process of getting married, and partly I wanted to do it because I'd got married the previous year, and I was really struck by, I mean, I wasn't particularly traditional at all, you know, I was quite happy to just pop along to the register office without any kind of fuss, and then I found, you know, a lot of pressure, you know, you've got to, you know, maybe we'll be very upset if you don't invite her, and are you sure you don't want ribbons on the car? What, you know, and I thought, okay, well, there's a lot going on here that I don't quite understand. Why have this big ritual, and what does it do in terms of a status passage, in terms of a rite of passage from single to married, and then what does that mean in society? Why do we do it? You know, so those were the things that were driving all of that. But the fortuitous thing was that there was a cartographer working on Orton's survey called Janet. Now, I can't remember for the life of me Janet's surname, but she was a young woman. She was younger than me. And she had just recently got engaged. And you could see her. She would walk down the corridor with her left arm out, flashing her engagement ring to everybody, for everybody to see. She was so proud of the fact that she'd got engaged and she'd got this ring. And Janet and her partner, Bernard, became my first participants in my study. And I can remember asking where she lived, and she said, well, we live in the Errols. And I didn't know where on earth that was. And it's actually, she meant Hare Hills. But I thought, I didn't know where the Errols were, you know, but she was up in Hare Hills. So I meant, you know. So then what I did, because it kind of fitted the tradition of the thing, was to follow, I've actually followed 12 young couples through the process of getting married. So I interviewed them probably four or five, maybe half a dozen times over the space of the year. And some of them I got through word of mouth, but they all lived up on the old Bankside or Hare Hills, that sort of area. And I remember sort of crossing the city from Leafy, Headingley, on the bus, and it was like going into a different world up there. So it almost felt anthropological, you know, it was an ethnographic study, I think that's how it's described, getting married, an ethnographic and bibliographic study, I think was how it was called. And I, as I said, I followed those couples over time. I went to all their weddings and I filmed them for them and gave them a copy of the film. And it sort of cost me a fortune in wedding presents, you know, but they were thrilled with the idea that somebody would be there to film them. But I can remember, you know, a lot of them lived in those little back-to-back houses, and up on the old Bankside, it was in the 1970s, it was a slum clearance area. So you would walk along, you know, there were streets laid out, but they're just rubble. And then there were still some of the old back-to-backs there. And I can remember one of the women in my study, Chrissy, and her husband. But Chrissy came out of her front door to get into a big Rolls Royce, dressed all in her white regalia. And it was a little back-to-back you know, with a front door absolutely on the street and lines of washing across the street. You know, so this sort of, in, you know, this like having your one special day and dressing up and doing all of that really made a big difference, you know. So I had great fun doing that study, although I found it absolutely nerve-wracking because this was the first time I'd done a study like that. And sometimes I'd end up going down to the pub or to the Working Men's Club, where a lot of the people went that I interviewed. And that was quite fascinating because one of the couples, I remember, said to me, "Do you know, we've just spoken to you and you've had your tape recorder on, but we've been telling you a pack of lies." And then they'd tell me whatever the truth was. And I think, can I use this data? You know, the tape recorder's off, you know. We didn't have the controls and the consent forms as you have today. It was really very different. So all of that was, the ethics of it were quite interesting, really. And then I did a final interview after they were married. Went back to ask them what that whole event had meant to them, what had the ritual meant, you know. And, you know, there was one bride who, well, in fact, there were two couples out of the 12 who were living up on the old Bankside, and their ambition was to move to Headingley, right? They were, you know, they'd been to university, they'd got different ideas, different perspectives on life. They wanted to move away from their working class roots, basically. But one of them, you know, very much like me, had sort of dressed up and so on. And she said to me, you know, when I put that wedding dress on, she said, I was so nervous, but suddenly I just went into this calmness and I just felt it was like an out-of-body experience and I just floated through it. And what drove the whole thing was Arnold van Gennep's Rites of Passage. I don't know if you've read that book. And there it was, people saying exactly the sorts of things that van Gennep had been saying in 1909. So it was wonderful, really. But what I came up with in that thesis was, which has never been published, was the idea that people, you know, there's this idea of speech acts and how important they are. You know, that you are making a declaration, a promise. And therefore you're doing something instrumental by making a commitment, and you're doing it, and the instrumentality is through the expressiveness. So, you know, you're using the symbols as a way to reinforce the change of status that you're going through, you know. And there was no other work like it. And I remember being very frustrated and sort of looking at the literature and thinking, no one else is doing anything. You know, I haven't got anything to go on. And then Tony said to me, actually, that's a good thing. You know, you're a pioneer here. The only other study had been done by a woman called Diana Leonard. And she had done a study also called Getting Married. She was looking just at the gendered nature of it, the relationships between the men and women. She wasn't looking at the process. She wasn't looking at the life course change. So again, it was quite novel. And that started me off on doing this qualitative longitudinal research, which has been a hallmark of everything I've done since. So that's probably, and I'm rambling. But anyway, that was my PhD at the Institute. But I'm just going to sort of flip now to something that was interesting, because when I was working as the archivist at the Institute, and as I said, I left in about 1980 because we moved to London, and I was still trying to finish my research then. I'd done all the field work, but I was writing up, but everything was so slow, and it was a year, I remember, where I did nothing on it because I was working. So anyway, I remember being in the archive, and it must have been 79 or something like that. And every year, a journalist came from The Guardian to look at the crop of dissertations that had been done. And he always wrote some witty piece. And usually Stuart Sarnason would be there, and he would vet what the journalist could see. And he would look after him, bring him in, and show him various things, you know. And then there'd be a nice witty piece in The Guardian about whatever it was. And on this particular occasion, I think it was in my last year that I was there, Stuart wasn't around, and the Guardian journalist turned up. And so I let him in, and I gave him a free range, really, to whatever he wanted. And I remember there was a thesis that, it was an MA dissertation, but it was really very interesting because it was about the researcher had done a structural analysis of graffiti in the boys and girls, well, the men and women's toilets at the university. Now, I think she was a she, and she had got a friend, colleague, whatever, boyfriend maybe, to jot down all the graffiti in the men's. And then she'd done a really beautiful analysis of the different themes, what was, you know, why people would write on walls. And again, it's that thing about how you use those little spaces in your life to create messages that you might not be able to articulate in any other way. It was really, really interesting. And it was a very nice gendered analysis. But also it was exploring, as I said, all those things that maybe can't be said in any other way. And the journalist loved this, and he then wrote about it in The Guardian. But following on from that, there was then a question asked in the House of Commons about a waste of public money with this IDFLS. Because there we were doing all of this work, which wasn't regarded as, you know, this was not academic work. This was just on the margins. This was ordinary everyday life, which of course was the hallmark of what we did. Nowadays, getting at people's lived experiences is what everything's about, and that's fine. But back then it wasn't fine, you know. And I think that, for me, that was probably the beginning of the end of the Institute, because there'd been this question in the House of Commons. It's apparently it's in Hansard. You might want to go and look up Hansard and see what's been said. So, you know, and I remember getting into a little bit of trouble about the fact that I'd let the journalist in and let him loose on, you know, whatever the dissertations were. So there you are, some of my stories from way back then. I'm going to stop and you have to ask me something. I'm getting hoarse.
Can you tell me a bit about your supervisors and other people who are working in the Institute?
Well, I start with Stuart, who was a very gentlemanly, kindly, lovely man. But as I said, was very much of the old school, the old folklore collecting sort of mentality, which wasn't really my thing. Tony, who was doing his own PhD in the Institute and was a lecturer there, much more lively and into the sociology and... So, you know, I got to know Tony really very well, and he was great. He was really good. That was all that there was on the Folklife side. I mean, obviously I knew Stanley because he used to come in and have a chat and have a coffee with me. And that was really nice. And that was a large collection of photographs that had been taken for the survey. And again, I archived them all and documented them all and so on, you know. So... And there were some lovely ones of Stanley. I mean, there's a famous one of him just sort of standing in a great coat and with his microphone, you know, his big, big microphone. And I remember him coming in looking at, and I said, that Stan, there's a lovely photo of you here. And he said, oh, yes, he said, I was a very ill man when that was taken, he said. And I think it was at the time he was going through a divorce. But, you know, you didn't kind of open up those things. But, you know, generally it was a very nice place to be. And I, you know, it was sort of golden 6 years for me being involved in all of that. Apart from these little blips like the Guardian person coming in. And, you know, it really set me off on a journey. I mean, the other thing to say is that when I was doing my PhD, I had two really quite close friends. Ginny Dunn, and she had come from New Zealand, I think on a British Council fellowship, to look at traditional singing in Snape and Blacksaw. Now, you wouldn't be able to interview Ginny because she died a few years ago, which is very, very sad. But she did a fantastic there. She was the brightest of all of us and was academically absolutely there, and we all sort of revered her, and she was just a lovely person. But I remember her going down to Snape and Blacksaw and discovering this wonderful tradition of singing in the local pubs. So this is singing without music accompaniment. And there was a very strong sense of ownership of the songs by the local singers. And so she would go to the pubs and do the recordings and then interview, it was usually men, but there were also some women, them about the songs and where they sat in people's lives. And she wrote a lovely book, which is still available. I've got a copy. It's called The Fellowship of Song. I don't know if you know that. And one of the interesting stories was that, you know, Snape and Blacksaw is the home of Benjamin Britten and the Albrecht Festival and so on. Now, one of the people that Ginny interviewed, I think his name was Bob, but he was Benjamin Britten's gardener. And, you know, Benjamin Britten was quite like folk song, you know, I mean, he would take them and did it, but he knew nothing about this tradition of singing on his doorstep, under his nose, going on in the local pubs, you know, and Judy was able to write about all of that. So I thought that was absolutely fabulous. But it was sad because that didn't go anywhere particularly for Ginny, because she had quite a lot of problems in her personal life and in her marriage. And she followed her husband and supported him in his career rather than developing her own. And I think she ended up just doing what she would say just doing, but copy editing work. And so she didn't develop her academic career, but she would have been, you know, a top-notch academic had she done that. And I've caught up with her on several occasions over the years. And then, as I said, she died of cancer some years ago now. And then the other close friend was Simon Lishman. Have you heard of him? Do you know him? Simon is Jewish. And he and his wife, Ravanna, moved after the institute closed, because I think they were still doing their research when I left in 1980. And Simon and Ravanna moved to Jerusalem, where they've been ever since. I think maybe he went via an American university to actually finish his doctorate. I don't know exactly what the story is there. But he has done such interesting things with the work. Again, all stemming from the Institute, but taking it off in different directions. Because what Simon and Ravanna wanted to do was to build bridges between the communities in Jerusalem, right, between the Israelis and the Arabs. And so Simon has devoted the whole of his life to this, going into local schools and running folklore projects. So he'll get the children engaged in cooking traditions, food traditions, song, dance, whatever it is, and he'll go into schools from both sides of the community, crossing the wall, and then he'll bring them together for a festival. And it's not just the children, of course, it's the parents as well. And then they realise just how much they've got in common, because they're eating the same food and their songs are very similar. And so he's been working all of that time building bridges through the traditional cultures, which he, you know, like I did, I suppose, you know, we embraced all of that through the Institute. And I think it's wonderful that he's still doing that work today, and it's, you know, building the bridges there. And I think it was 2019 was the last time I was in Jerusalem with him. I was teaching at Tel Aviv University I had a week residency there. So we then went over to Jerusalem to spend some time with Simon and Ravanna. And I went to one of his schools, which was an Arab school just tucked away behind the wall, and you had to go through the wall to get to it. And, you know, I spent a lovely morning in the school playing marbles with children and pick up sticks and, you know, all sorts of things like that. But, you know, it's through these cultural activities, because they cross all sorts of boundaries, and they cross language boundaries. You know, it's just so important. So that Simon story, and again, you can see the different directions that people will go in, having all been there at that moment in the 70s at the Institute, you know. And then there's me with my, you know, qualitative longitudinal hat on, you know, and developing an academic career. But, you know, there are many other routes, aren't there, beyond what you do, but beyond, you know, the academic stuff that you start with.
You've said quite a bit about sort of traditional versus newer approaches. Can you say a bit about how you've seen folklife studies and sociology change over the course of your career?
Yeah, absolutely. Because as I said, I think back then in the 1970s, I had no links whatsoever with the sociology department, and yet I've been, you know, a member of staff, including a professor there for many years. I think I got my chair in something like 2009 or something like that. But, you know, way back in the 1970s, everything was driven by this positivist view of the world. And, you know, there were large-scale surveys, and everything that we were doing fell under the radar of that. So it wasn't counted. It wasn't counted in any of the survey work. And there were very famous studies going on in sociology at that time. In the 1960s, for example, Goldthorpe, I think his name was doing a fantastic study on employment opportunities for young people. And when he came to publish that, and there were lots of interviews done, but all of the interview material was on the cutting room floor. It was taken out because it wasn't sociological enough. Now, what's happening since is that all that data was archived, fortunately, and people like Mike Savage, who's a, you know, very well-respected sociologist, has come along and pieced together that data, taken it off the cutting room floor, and has been able to say, actually, we can now reconstruct that history, because we have people's real accounts of what was going on in their lives. And we don't just have to look across the numbers, because there were probably 900 people in the survey or something. We can start piecing together the actual tales of what's happened for people. So I think that's very interesting. I mean, another study which I absolutely love, Henrietta, now what's her surname? I have to try to remember. Anyway, some colleagues at Leicester who in the year 2000 discovered several box files full of data which had been languishing since the 1960s. And that was a study of, again, of employment, right, an employment-based study. And it was looking at the journeys of young people going from school into work. And what that research was actually doing was, looking back, was filling in a missing piece of the puzzle about why, you know, what was going on for ordinary people in the 1960s. I mean, we say that by the time we've got to the 1980s, there's an absolute crisis for young people in education and the journey into work. But actually, that crisis was probably there earlier. I don't know. It's John Goodwin and Henrietta O'Connor who did this work at Leicester. So they discovered these box files, and they decided that they would do several things with them. They thought, it's the year of the millennia, we will revisit that data. So they did a wonderful secondary analysis of all the data, because the thing is, the data had been collected originally by a very famous sociologist, Elias, who was German, actually. And so he'd been at Leicester. And then I'm afraid, as sometimes happens in research teams, the research team fell out in a big way. So he went back to Germany, and nobody ever did anything with this data. It was just left languishing for all those years. This is a good reason why we must archive our data and why we're setting up archives to to make sure this doesn't happen. But, you know, it's very fortuitous that, you know, Henrietta and John came along and discovered this data set. So they set about a secondary analysis of all that data. But they were also able to, there were about several hundred people in that survey, in that sample. And I think Elias and his team had done a couple of interviews with them. So it was longitudinal as well. They were able, because the contact details were all there, they set about finding some of them. Now, they maybe found about 100 of those original people and interviewed them. And then they began to piece together not just the sort of historical, the big historical picture, but the biographical picture. How had the lives of these people changed relating back to their experiences in the 1960s? And it's just absolutely fascinating that they were able to do that. And so that's, you know, they've published absolutely widely out of that study, but I just love it. Now, that's the kind of thing we can do and that's valuable now in, you know, since the turn of the millennium. That was, you know, none of that data was regarded as valuable back in the 1960s. It just wasn't. So that's where we've come to, that actually the voices of ordinary everyday people are really important, that we need to not only give them a voice but give them an audience, that maybe we ought to be following in the path of oral historians and indeed the folk life movement by allowing people to have their own names, because otherwise we just airbrush them out of the historical record. So all of these, I think, are, you know, amazing changes from where we were back then. So I think, you know, when you go back and you start to look at it again, you think, well, we were, you know, we might have been regarded as sort of a bit, you know, nutcases and on the fringes, but we were doing important work back then, and which has come into its own since.
Can you say a bit more about the relationship between dialectologists and folklorists in the Institute?
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because I wasn't on the dialect side, so my knowledge of that is hazy. But I think, you know, I think as I was saying earlier, I think, you know, Stuart in particular was, you know, very interested in these sayings and so on. And that fits in, doesn't it, with a kind of, you know, I mean, just that whole idea from the dialect survey that you'd be interested in how people phrased things, you know, and the nature of people's intonation and the words that they use regionally and so on. You know, that is, I mean, the bigger message there is that, that, you know, it's not like we're going to have received standard English and everything else is going to be on the side, because everybody's way of speaking is fundamental to their identity and their sense of community. And so, you know, it's a different way of piecing everything together. And, you know, again, that's come into its own, I think. I mean, I'm sure the survey was very important back then. It wasn't, the folk life bit was a bit on the side, I think, back then. And even now, I thought it was, you know, as I said, you know, going into a seminar and seeing people Morris dancing for half an hour, I think, what is this about? But it was about ordinary everyday life. So, and I think, so, you know, again, the work that I did, which was just this little, a little tiny dissertation, but it was about just the sayings that people have. And again, how language, how actually we shape who we are in our identities through our language. So I think that was all a part of it, and that linked the two sides, really. And I think for a lot of my colleagues who went in, really being interested in local crafts and traditions, you know, like the mummers' plays, well dressing, and craft work like dry stone walling and so on, they're interested in not just the activities that people have, but the way they shape those activities through language. So that was all part of it. So there was a strong link, I would say, across the two. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Excuse me. And were you aware of the work of the Folklife Survey in Yorkshire?
What, more recently? Or
at the time?
No. No, I mean, I remember that there was some, I think, I was aware of the fact that there was a lot of work going on in Sheffield, and it was like in competition with what we were doing, but it was much more successful than I think what we were doing. And I just felt we were a bit too small and somewhat marginalised in the university. But I don't know that I've... Yeah, it was a sort of feeling that that was the case. So was this out of Sheffield? No, it wasn't. So who was running that?
Sanderson, I think. It was
all... It was? Oh, okay.
Carrying on from what the Survey of English Dialects had done.
Yeah.
Focusing more on folk life.
Right, no, not really. No. So, I mean, I've got, you know, I was just sort of ploughing one particular bit of the furrow and I'm sure there's all sorts of things going on that I didn't know about. But
can you say more about the closure of the Institute?
Well, I think by the time it closed, assuming that, you know, you just told me earlier, it was probably 83, 84. So that was after I'd left. And I was still, I didn't submit my PhD until 1985. So I was still a student. But I wasn't based in Leeds. I mean, we went to London. This was with my ex-husband's work. We went to London for 18 months and then to Oxford, actually, living in Leckford Road. And I was working. Again, I always had to find some work to support what I was doing. So I started working for the Open University and they had an advisory service for new students. So I fronted that up and developed it. I remember the first sitting there on my first day and my very first phone call, somebody phoned up and said, I could do with a bit of help. And I said, I'm here to help. What would you like? She said, well, basically, should I want to change my life? I said, right, okay, that's lovely. And that was lovely. You know, that was the work that I was doing in Oxford. And I think I was there for a couple of years. So by this time, it would have been about 93, 94. And what I did, I'd got some very good friends in Leeds who used to go away for the whole of the summer. They went to CERN in Switzerland, who's a physicist. And I stayed in their house and babysat the cats and went to the university library every day. And I had, I don't know if you know, but in the basement of the Brotherton, there are lots of little rooms around the edge, and they were all for the postgraduates, and you could book a room and keep it, and that's where I kept all my stuff. So I would have long periods where I did nothing on the research, then I'd come back for 2 or 3 weeks and just work solidly on it. I mean, the sad thing was that I think when the Institute closed, Tony moved on, and he went to Bretton Hall, you know, which fitted his interest in the mummers and, you know, traditional arts and so on. And so I then became rudderless, really, because I'd lost a supervisor. And although, you know, Tony was very good to me in all sorts of ways and we, you know, and was very inspiring, but I did feel very isolated, very much on my own in completing the research, really. And I remember I used to come back, as I said, I used to come back quite regularly. But, you know, those were the days where there weren't any computers back then. You know, when I wrote up chapters and sent them to Tony, I hand wrote them. I'd laboriously, you know, have a script. And this is a funny story. Completely, it still remains a complete mystery. But there was one occasion where I sent Tony 2 chapters from my thesis that I'd been sort of slavering away on. And I didn't hear anything for ages from him. And eventually I think I phoned him up or sent him a letter and said, Tony, did you get those chapters? And he said, no, I've never got them. So I started that laborious process of writing it all again, which was terrible. Now, I think by this time, it must have been around that time, the School of English moved to its current home. And there was a woman whose name escapes me, but she was the mainstay of the department. So she was the departmental secretary. Can't remember her name. She was wonderful. You know, if you got a query or anything, you went to her.
Was it Vera Cracknell?
Might have been. Can't quite remember. And I remember that... there was a nice common room area, probably still there. And I used to go there and sometimes meet up with Douglas Jefferson, the old professor, and have morning tea, because he used to come in throughout his life. For years after he retired, he would come in with packets of biscuits to share with the secretaries and have his morning coffee, you know, in the common room. But anyway, these chapters, as I said, had gone missing. And one day I got this phone call from the departmental secretary saying, your chapters have turned up. And when I went to collect them, she said they were found under, she said they've been found under a chair in the common room, still in their brown paper wrapping. I've never got to the bottom of it. I've never gone there. It's too difficult to find out what happened to my chapters. But anyway, they were there, so I then rediscovered them. But those were the sorts of strange things that could go on, you know. And I think it's because, I mean, the whole thing sort of imploded, really, that people were going off into their new lives. It wasn't possible for Tony to carry on supervising me, so I was then allocated a supervisor in the School of English. Can't for the life of me remember his name now, because it was all so shadowy. I mean, basically, I was on my own doing this work, which is partly why it took me so long. I felt, and I remember when I started, Tony saying to me, you know, you won't know much about all of this now, but by the time you finish, you will be a world expert on your topic. Well, you know, I always say to my students the exact opposite. I said, this is a training. It's a training. You know, one of your, you know, concluding bits will be a section on what it is that you could have done differently and what still needs to be remaining to be done, because you are not going to be the expert in everything. It's a training. Yeah, so it's a different kind of thing, which I think partly was why back then, I mean, you only have one supervisor. Many students were on the books for years and years and years and they never finished. There, you know, nowadays, or certainly, you know, because my last PhD student finished about 2 years ago, you know, we have much tighter controls to prevent people falling through the cracks like that. You know, and there's always two, certainly in sociology and social policy, has to be two supervisors, and sometimes a third methodological one, so that students are much better supported, really. So that was quite difficult. Anyway, I was allocated this chap from the School of English, and I think he was a specialist in American literature, or he might have even been American. I can't quite remember the link now, but I remember going to knock on his door one day, and I'd never met him. This is in the School of English where it is now, you know, the lovely buildings, and I knocked on the door, and I'd got this appointment. And from the other side of the door, I could hear all these strange noises, grunting and groaning. And I'm thinking, I don't think I want to go through that door. So I started to tiptoe away, and the door was flung open. And this man was standing there in his jogging stuff with a headband around his head. And all over the floor were weights. And he was doing weight training in the room. And he apologised, said, I'm so sorry, I've missed the time, and I've just been doing my weights, you know. Oh, did I knock it off?
There you go. Oh, good.
So, anyway, you know, I kind of went in and I sort of, you know, talked to him about where I was with the thesis, and I think I just got one more chapter to do or something, you know. And he would just sort of nod sagely and say, yes, this is fine, that's fine, that's fine. You know, so that's why, I mean, actually, because I started that research in about 75, 70, 76, and it was 9 years, you know. Now, admittedly, I was only doing it part-time, but, you know, I think I was one of the victims of the fact that the Institute was closing and that people were going off and doing their, you know, their own things. But, you know, I mean, Ginny had got her doctorate very quickly. I think she did it in under the 3 years. Simon suffered, and he had to go to America, I think, to finish his. And there were other people that just dropped by the wayside. So I think, you know, you can't, if you haven't got an institutional base there, and if you haven't got staff that are well supported, then they can't pass that on to the students, really.
Did you get a sense of the mood around that closure, or reasons?
Not really, because I was living in Oxford, really, and I would just come back and I'd go and see this American guy assuming he was American, whoever it was who was supervising me. And I remember going into my Viva and Tony wasn't there. You know, it's for me, Tony was still my supervisor, but he couldn't do it. You know, that was fair enough. But I didn't have anybody else really that knew my subject because we were too small. We were a small, you know, isolated little group of people. And I think that sort of, you know, again, that ethos of, you know, working at the edges, you know, at a time where you couldn't easily do that, you know, it just imploded. So, you know, that was sad, really. So, you know, I had some mixed feelings about that because I thought, you know, had I, and it's affected my own work in the sense that, you know, I've supervised many PhD students myself and I give my all for them. I'm always there, you know. Probably do too much, but it's in effect, I never would want people to go through what I went through, you know. And I was very fortunate. I had to choose my own external, who was a chap called Simon Charsley, and he'd just written a paper about wedding rituals and why they were important. And it was a sociological analysis, and I thought, so he was supportive. Because I don't think anybody else in the School of English knew anything about what I was doing. It would have been completely alien to them. Because really, I was a sort of, you know, like sheep in lamb's clothing or the other way around. You know, I was somewhat out of place because I was really a sociologist working in the School of English. So, anyway, I survived. I survived all of that. And then once I got the PhD, then I was able to develop, you know, a research career based on the PhD. And it was always in the context of life course changes because that was what had driven the, you know, the PhD, this rite of passage from one status to another. So I did studies on, I think the first study that I worked on, let me think, was a study on, have you heard of something called Munchausen by proxy? Yeah. So I was following up a caseload of, I was working with a child psychiatrist, and we went all over the country revisiting the caseload of Roy Meadow, who was already somewhat controversial at the time that I was doing this research, to find out what had happened down the line for all these children who had been discovered to be subjected to, basically, it's a form of abuse. I mean, I went in and said, we've got to call this what it is. You know, these children are being abused. You know, there may be all sorts of reasons why. So I would call it Munchausen by proxy abuse because I didn't want to see it as some kind of medical syndrome. But we discovered that many of the mothers, because it was usually the mothers that perpetrated this, many of them had just moved from one locality, one local authority to another, and then it would start all over again. I remember we visited one child who, at the age of 5 or 6, had been in a wheelchair, and yet was nothing wrong with that child. And by the time we followed up that child, he was in his 20s and he was still in a wheelchair. Yeah, so it's very hard doing that kind of research. But again, it was a sort of long-term piecing together what had happened and going back and piecing together. But I know Chris Balls was the person that I was working with, a psychologist, psychiatrist, and we would go and visit some of these children and just want to take them home with us, you know. It was very, so that was the first piece of research that I did. Then I moved to Trent Palliative Care Centre. So I was looking at processes of death and dying and how people manage that, and looking at the carers, again, the family dynamic. That was lovely. I was working with David Clark down there. So I had 3 very happy years down there. I was living in Leeds and commuting, just as you're doing now. And I was working part-time because by then I'd got young children myself. And so I would go to Sheffield. I'd commute to Sheffield 2 days a week and then have a 3rd day working at home. And then from there, by this time we've got to 1994, and that was when I joined sociology and social policy, and it was a study on divorce. So I'd gone from child abuse to death to divorce. These very difficult things. But all the time, I used to come back to these ideas about process and how important they are. And, you know, we might want to go in and just take a snapshot of people's lives, but if we don't understand the processes, if we don't understand the longer picture, we're not ever going to get to the movie of people's lives. So, you know, that's the defining feature of what I do. But it all started at the Institute.
Have you got any other Institute-based memories you'd like to share?
Oh, gosh, I think I've gone through most things.
How does it feel to know that the Leeds Archive of Vernacular Culture exists now and that your thesis is in it?
It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. I mean, the only... and I'm so pleased because, again, I think this is part of this rediscovery and how, you know, academic traditions or, you know, whatever's flavour of the month or the flavour of the year, well, this is the flavour now. And I hope it really lasts and flourishes, and you really deserve some more money. The only thing that I'd like to pursue, if possible, is I've still got all the tapes from my PhD, and there are about 100 of them. All the data was generated on old reel-to-reel tape recorders, these little portable ones, about that big. So I've got all these old reel-to-reel tapes, and I would just like to, I mean, it may well be that they're, irreparably damaged, I don't know. But I've got no way of finding out. And they're just in my study upstairs, just sitting on the shelf up there. So I don't know whether there's probably not enough money or whatever, but it just, if there was an old reel-to-reel tape recorder and we could try and play them. But if they are still... if they do still have data on, then all of those rich interviews that I did from the 1970s about people getting married, you know, all of that data would still be there because they were never fully transcribed. I mean, I've got notebooks for each person with, you know, a rough transcription, but that's not the same, you know, as...
of course. I know some video recordings of yours and things are in the archive, but are these extra...
Are there? Mm. What are they? That's interesting.
Have a look.
Know that.
Let's have a browse, but maybe I'll just stop there for now to say thank you, Brendan, so much for your time, and it's been such a privilege.
It's been a pleasure for me too.